This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Dave Brown, and this is a podcast version of AMI's Morning Show, Now with Dave Brown. Catch the live broadcasts weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern on AMI Audio and AMI TV.
Welcome back. It's the Now News Panel on AMI. I'm Dave Brown alongside Juita Gupta and Michelle McQuigg. Let's talk about our next topic. The Buffalo supermarket shooting continues to resonate after 10 black victims were killed by a white shooter last weekend. The shooter had previously posted online about his intentions and his belief in the racially driven Great Replacement Theory. You may be wondering, what is the Great Replacement Theory? The idea is that a cabal is attempting to replace white Americans with non-white people through immigration, interracial marriage, and violence. It's a theory that takes up some space in dark corners of the internet, but it's also one that has been platformed by people like Tucker Carlson on his webcast and has even appeared in places like the National Post in Canada. Juita, this is a difficult topic. How do you want to approach it?
Is that we can talk about it. Certainly, you've hinted at the social media angle, and that's something to talk about, as well as how we approach conversations about race and racism, both in the United States and Canada. But I think it is worth reflecting that racism and anti-black racism specifically isn't just an American problem. So while it has been a week of sober reflection for those in the United States, I think we have to ask ourselves some tough questions here at home as well.
Yeah, I think the Canadian perspective on this is pretty clear. Beyond anti-black racism, racially driven violence in Canada exists, right? We don't need to look much further than the mosque shooting or the family that was run down in London, Ontario, last year. I mean, it exists, right? This is not strictly an American problem. What makes it a particularly poignant American problem, though, is the gun control side of the conversation as well, right? That we certainly have our mass shootings in Canada and we have our gun control problems. One of the reasons why I was a little bit numb to this story for most of the week is because there were 4 mass shootings in America last weekend. There was one the night before this shooting outside a Milwaukee Bucks basketball game where nearly a dozen people got killed. There's something about it that just washes over us, right? So, Juita, I'm glad that you bring in the Canadian side to this conversation as well. But, Michelle, we mentioned social media in the intro there, and we know social media and mass media play a role in this. How big a role do you think it played?
It's so hard to say. I don't think this is the primary driver, but I do think that it helps propagate some of these theories like Great Replacement that, it's worth noting, have been just thoroughly debunked. These are not real things. And I also would like to point out that theories like the Great Replacement approach are not unique and confined to anti-black racism. They have deeply, deeply anti-Semitic roots. Mm-hmm. These are schools of thought that are mired in hate. And we know that social media and online climates have allowed those ideas to spread. So does it play a role? Absolutely. Did these types of thinking exist prior to social media? You bet it did. So I would hesitate to say that this is a primary driver of this, but it is, we can't really get away from it in this context. Yeah. The gunman has openly said that he got radicalized towards the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic when he was bored and checking out 4chan. Mm. So this comes back to some conversations around hate speech laws, which we've talked about on this panel before, and where some of these lines are drawn. But I think what it does do is prove the immediacy of some of these conversations and the fact that this is happening at home as well. Yeah. As you've said, this is not confined to the U.S. The fact that it happened in Buffalo puts it about as close to home as you can get in a Canadian commune.
Yeah. When we talk about social media, we talked a couple weeks ago about how sometimes it's a positive in the way that it helps people find community, but it can also be an extreme negative in the way that it can find acceptance for ideas like Great Replacement in some of those corners that you find a different kind of community. Juita, your thoughts on the way in which the internet, social media, and mass media have played into this?
You folks have covered off a lot of it in the sense that the shooter was clearly radicalized online. But here's the question I've been asking myself. He clearly shared his manifesto with a community of like-minded people. And yet not one person saw something on the internet and felt they needed to report it to the police. Mm. And what happened to the people who are supposed to be watching out for these things on social media platforms and, you know, kind of monitoring the situation? Who fell asleep at the wheel here? It's really distressing. And as for Tucker Carlson, you know, it's not that it's necessarily provided a mainstream platform for the great replacement theory, but it has, at least he's mentioned it on a show at least 400 times.
Yeah.
So it stopped being this fringe theory. I mean, it is still pretty much on the margins, but it is somewhat more mainstream than it would have been. And I read this really critical post about this, which said that not only is it enough for us to talk about social media and the role of some mainstream media outlets, we have to dig even deeper and ask about who's advertising them. And why is it that advertisers are not being held to account? So there's a lot of questions that need to be asked here. And saying that social media radicalized the shooter is obviously a statement of fact, and it's true. But we have to dig deeper and look closer at the situation and ask, why did nobody think to report this when they saw the manifesto circulating online?
Joita, you sent us a lot of reading material on this topic. and one of the things that jumped out to you is that one commentator said the conversation around anti-Black racism and anti-Black racism, and I would argue racism more broadly, that it's going to get worse in the United States before it gets better. I want to give you first reaction to that, because you flagged the article. What's your reaction?
Actually, I heard that on The Current. It was a story on Monday where the commentator was an organizer in that neighborhood in Buffalo where the shooting had taken place. He'd organized a vigil, and the question was put to him, do you think it's going to get worse before he said it'll get better? And he said, yes, it will get worse. And the reason it'll get worse is because we have to put this incident into context, and the context is Black Lives Matter and the groundswell of support that BLM had. And now there's backlash to BLM. And that's what's really festering here. And so we need to contextualize the backlash and also think about the fact that people are looking for others to blame. We just talked about the inflation in the previous segment. Every time you have an economic downturn, people in a place of privilege who are struggling to pay bills, pay for their groceries, keep a roof over their head, they find a scapegoat, someone to blame for all of their problems. So it isn't just boredom. It's also a deep sense of alienation that has propelled this anti-Black racism. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence to back it up. In 2020, 64.9% of all hate crimes reported in the United States targeted Black people. And that number had doubled between 1990 and 2020. So clearly things are getting worse. And the way things are going, they will continue to get worse before they get better.
Yeah, so many disingenuous conversations are had by politicians about inclusion or about racism. It's almost been politicized to talk about racism when I think it should be quite obvious and evident that inclusion and being anti-racist are a good thing. But people have found, again, they found a voice, they found a voter block, they found people who will unwaveringly support them. So I hate the sentiment that it's going to get worse, but it does feel, and Michelle, I'm going to steal one of your expressions here, it does feel the polarization is playing into this. But Michelle, your reaction to the commentator that Joita identified.
Are you implying that I was going to bring polarization into this conversation?
I mean, there was a chance.
As it happens, I completely agree with you. It's hard to escape the feeling that this is heading down an increasingly difficult and dangerous road, and we know the forces at play there. We know, as we just talked about, that social media has allowed a lot of these things to not just take root but proliferate further than they might have before. And I think we are seeing things get worse. I mean, we could have theoretically learned from the Charleston church shooting some years ago, and yet here we are today talking about a very similar type of targeted attack in Buffalo. So I think Joita said a lot of it really well. A lot of the movements that have taken place for the good have then engendered some backlash, and these are now going to play out in various contexts, social and political, I'm afraid.
Yeah. I hope you guys don't think I'm flippant when I look at one of the questions that Joita sent us. And Joita, I'm gonna read the question verbatim, and I hope you're not think my response to it is a bit flippant, but then I want to give you a chance to react. You wrote, "What approach would you take in having conversations with white youth about anti-Black racism?" My response to that would be is you actually have to have the conversation. And so many school boards and states in the U.S. right now, and my apologies for focusing on the U.S., but it's been so prominent the way in which some states like Florida are creating these straw men of critical race theory. and almost refusing to talk about anti-Black racism. So, Juita, I hope you don't think I'm being flippant when I say, how would I approach it? I mean, you actually have to have the conversation. And there's so many places that are even unwilling to have the baseline conversation, let alone the complex conversation.
No, not at all. In fact, you know, I'm used to sharing a brain with Michelle. But as it turns out, we are sharing a brain today, Dave, because that is exactly where I was going with this question, where there has been a systematic backlash against critical race theory. And, you know, critical race theory, a lot of people don't actually understand what it is. And I don't say that to be patronizing. I say that because CRT has become something of a buzzword or a catchphrase. And really what critical race theory comes down to, it's a legal framework to understand why in the years after the civil rights movement, we continue to experience racism in a systemic fashion. So the backlash against critical race theory has meant that not only that we have taken the conversation about race and racism out of the classrooms. They have revised textbooks in places like Florida. They're telling a completely different story about, you know, civil reconstruction and slavery. So you're absolutely right, Dave. If we don't have a conversation about race, then we can't address racism. But if you'll allow me to dabble in anti-oppression a
little bit, please.
One of the things that we, you know, if you take anti-oppression trainings, they'll tell you to focus on your areas of oppression. You know, I'm a woman and I have a disability, but they'll also tell you to focus on your privilege. I can say that I'm university educated and I happen to be straight. So talking about your privilege in the situation becomes really important. But I often think about, or I would like to evoke James Baldwin, who wrote this excellent essay about the stranger in the village. I feel like Michelle has read it and might be able to sort of guess at where I'm going with this, where the problem of the Black man in America is really one that Baldwin points out is a question of identity for Americans. And so it's this fundamental question that people are wrestling with. What does it mean to be American? What does it mean to belong and to be a citizen? And how do Black people play into that conversation when America was conceptualized as a white colony? I mean, there's a whole other angle about indigenous people in America that we aren't really getting into. But I think the words and work of James Baldwin is really instructive in talking about how we move forward in this conversation, recognizing that in America, the Black man is here to stay, and he has made a place for himself in American life and has made a significant contribution to that country. And here in Canada, too.
Of course. Michelle, I know that it's a difficult question, but do you have a sense of how we should be having these conversations, especially with young people? Because there are some generational divides here that we may never solve. But of course, talking to young people is somewhere to begin.
Absolutely. It is a complex question, but a really good one, Juita. I thought it was a great question that you asked him. I'm glad you did. I completely agree with everything you've said about the need to even have these conversations and establish some baselines. But the one thing I will add to this is I don't think any of these lessons will stick without the amplification and inclusion of Black voices, whether it's survivors of race-based violence, people who have witnessed some of what happens that we've just talked about, some of these mass shootings or other kinds of racist attacks, whether it's the brilliant minds and incredibly eloquent words of the likes of James Baldwin or Maya Angelou, or just tremendous, so many tremendous Black minds and Black people in history. That kind of exposure, I would like to think, could go some way to debunking some of the just straight up false claims inherent in great replacement theory or some of the other more racist schools of thought. But I do think it's absolutely critical that we hear about the lived experience of racism, both at the more extreme ends of the spectrum, like what happened in Buffalo, and just the more everyday senses of the kind of injustice that plays out that people don't want to think about. I don't think these kind of conversations can happen without including those voices who can speak to this in ways that we here on the panel simply cannot.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the spot to wrap up the conversation, mentioning that there are places that you can go to hear very authentic and genuine reaction to this and talk about the impact. One spot that I'll recommend is Pod Save the People with Dori McKesson. It's worth your time. It's worth a listen. The Right Time with Bomani Jones, always worth a listen as well.
You've been listening to Now with Dave Brown. Hit the subscribe button on any podcast platform and leave us a rating and a review.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.